Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. And for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much. And please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases, entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, I would really appreciate it if you would all do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular subject. This is one powerful way that we together can make a positive influence on the world. Now, Answers for the Family will continue to address a variety of issues, such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and creating greater health and happiness for you and your family. And we will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, happiness, and security, and in some cases, creating more joy for you and your family. Now, before I get to our guest, I just want to say that today we're going to discuss the evidence for and against widespread public masking as provided by the Centers for Disease Control, the Mayo Clinic, as well as top scientific publications such as the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet. These are all things that were touched upon that were in our guest book. Now, this debate needs to take place without fear and paranoia. Important questions are raised in our guest's new book, such as, what are the effects of masks on oxygen and carbon dioxide level? How does SARS-CoV-2 spread? What is the effectiveness of various types of masks? What about those who are most vulnerable to COVID-19? And whether our children should go back to school in the fall? And if so, what measures they should take? Now, as many of you know, I've been starting off each show with a quote. This one is by the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. So, I'd like everybody to really think about that as you kind of see what's going on and as you are watching television and listening to some of what the major media is doing or what some of the major social media networks are doing. Think about that. That is a declaration from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights from the United Nations. So anyway, our guest today, Dr. Judy Mikovits, has seen the best and the worst of science. When she was part of the research community that turned HIV and AIDS from a fatal disease into a manageable one, she believed she saw science at its best. But when her investigations questioned others' research as to whether the use of animal tissue in medical research could unleash devastating plagues of chronic diseases, such as autism or chronic fatigue syndrome, she believes she saw science at its worst. Now, if her suspicions are correct, we are looking at a realignment of scientific practices, including how we study and treat human disease. Now, Dr. Mikovits collaborated for more than 35 years with Dr. Frank Rusetti, one of the founders of the field of human virology. Her career in this field includes directing the National Cancer Institute's lab of antiviral drug mechanisms, serving as a senior scientist at the BioSource International and Epigenics Biosciences as chief scientific officer and VP of drug discovery. And while at Whitmore Peterson Nevada CFS Center for Neuroimmune Disorders, She served as their research director. Now, Dr. Minkowitz has a Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry with a specialization in biology from the University of Virginia. She has a PhD in biochemistry and molecular biology from Georgetown University. Dr. Minkowitz, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you, Ellen. I really appreciate being here today. It's so important, as you say, to be able to freely express really what's not my opinion, but what is scientific opinion that is not in any way conflicted in any interests other than in the public interest.
Well, and let's really start with that, because that's been one of the most disturbing things for me is, you know, I've been pulling up as much information as I possibly could from the time in which this started. I'm a detective by nature, and so research is something that's very important to me. And I was getting more and more disturbed as I would pull something up, and I would then try to fact check it and go into do more research, and then it would be gone. And somehow it would get wiped from the internet, and I couldn't even go back to really fact check it. Somebody else apparently was saying that whatever it was that their thoughts allowed them to be able to say that something was or wasn't acceptable for people to read. So let's talk a little bit about that before we really go into masks and stuff. How has that affected you?
Well, that's really at the center. What it's done to me is literally erase my entire career without merit, without any kind of due process, interpret data in a way that the data didn't speak to the interpretation the government was putting out. And that, as you mentioned earlier, with respect to the practice of our vaccine program since probably the late 80s and certainly the early 90s, where it became clear that the worst fears of our scientific research, that when you inject animal tissue a lot, including other people's aborted fetal tissue from you know, different sexes, opposite sexes, monkey blood, cow blood, pig blood, and you inject these directly into immunocompetent or even immune competent people, that you see a myriad of chronic debilitating disease development that has exploded in our country for the last 30 years. And it was clear in 2011 that a primary reason for the development of these diseases were the environmental toxins and the adventitious agents, the government has called it, other kinds of bacteria, other kinds of mycoplasma, mold, and retroviruses, that is AIDS-like viruses. They can cause acquired immune deficiencies and cancers exploding, and that's exactly what happened. So what happened to me was they erased my entire career and attempted to erase that of Dr. Resetti's as well. A little easier to do in our society when you're a woman, simply because we refuse to show anything but the raw data and refuse to allow propaganda to interpret those data in let's just say the Washington Post or the New York Times. And this is what we're seeing today with COVID-19 as data are propagandized or changed, or the interpretation of those reflecting political ideology that has nothing to do with science. And this is the problem.
Well, one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know, and if you could share, I don't know the specific date now, but you mentioned over the last 30 years. I mean, was it about 30 years ago when that law was passed that said that the big pharma companies that are putting together these various vaccines can't be held liable? Because I think that seems to be one of the biggest changes, because we've had vaccines before. When I was a kid, we had vaccines, but that number has grown so quickly, and add that to the point of having no recourse if something goes wrong. share exactly when that happened and how that may have changed the way in which science has gone about setting up vaccines for people.
Yeah, that act, it's called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act, that act was signed into law by then President Ronald Reagan in, it's interesting, November 14th of 1986. And I know that just because I defended my PhD on November 14th of 1991. So that act was signed into law, which removed liability from pharmaceutical companies for injuries from the vaccines. Because at the time, it was the DTP shot, so the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis. What was learned was that when the whole cell that the pertussis antigen, the bacteria virus that the pertussis was grown in, was not purified away from the antigen, that the injuries with the DTP shot were catastrophic, literally death and destroying the brains through encephalitis of the children at enormous rates. So simply I believe it was then Tony Fauci went to the government and said, we won't make your vaccines anymore if you don't relieve us from liability. And this was when it started, the inflection point. So that was signed into law in 1986 at the end of the year. But as we know with laws and things like that, it doesn't really get started until a few years later. So 1989 happens to be the inflection point, the explosion of chronic diseases parallels the explosion of the number of vaccines added to the schedules since then, again, free of liability. And what our work showed in between 2009 and the publication of a new family of mouse retroviruses, very, very important, associated with cancer and neuroimmune diseases. And that's why we founded, I was actually a co-founder of that institute in Nevada to develop a program to look at all of the diseases, cancer, autoimmune, neuroimmune, over a system-wide approach, as we had done to change the paradigm for HIV in the 80s. So you have to look at all the family and why some people are more susceptible than others. But at any rate, that discovery, it was published in Science in 2009, the isolation of this new family of viruses from the blood of sick people, and then the association of those with myalgic encephalomyelitis, which is inflammation of the brain and the spinal cord. It's called chronic fatigue syndrome in this country, and to stigmatize it. And it's been literally exploding since the 30s, the first cases in the 30s, which are described in our first book, Plague. And this is chapter 5 of Plague, is as that the first cases of autism and ME/CFS in this country. And it shows the association with the polio vaccines then passed through, where the enterovirus polio was passed through mouse brains. And so what happened was it picked up a dormant mouse virus that doesn't bother the mouse, but it can hurt some of the most. At the level they were in today was via contaminated that blood supply and contaminated vaccines. So this was, and so what was done to me once in 2011, it became clear this wasn't the 3 million people in this country with chronic fatigue syndrome, or at the time less than a million in 2011 with autism, that had been steadily increasing. 3-4% of our population now has some level of acquired, what I call acquired endocannabinoid immune deficiencies from these contaminants in vaccines. And because these people were stigmatized and considered crazy, they were allowed to donate blood. And so when the evidence continued to say, wait a minute, that is a problem. The mothers were called crazy. They continued to donate blood and receive blood without considering there was a real problem. And this backed all the way up to my career and understanding Ryan White and Arthur Ashe, who got infected and ultimately died from contaminated blood. So the government has been covering this up since that day. They attempted to get me to renounce the data. They offered me, prizes, money, job. When that didn't work, they simply arrested me, held me in jail without charges, on a fugitive from justice felony charge. I don't know where I was running. I was at home running down the beach, similar to the scene right behind you. But just the same, I was held in jail for 5 days while I was threatened without bail, on a bail hold. I was threatened. This was November 18th of 2011, 2 years after, when our data and the data around the world showed, oh my God, this is literally the nightmare that was predicted by them back in 1991. By then, the head of the National Cancer Institute. And then when we showed it came true, the answer was destroy the messenger. And this is what you were talking about at the top of the show with your quote. I think of George Orwell in 1984. And I saw that Bobby Kennedy posted a quote on Instagram this morning, or maybe yesterday. I just was tapping my phone and basically said what they do is they erase the history and replace it with a false one. So what they did to me was they erased me from existence from 2011 until to the present time. And now they've replaced the narrative with COVID-19. And COVID-19 is intended to kill those people, those 4 to 6% of Americans who are carriers of those mouse and cow and monkey viruses.
Well, in reading your new book, which is, as for everybody out there, The Case Against Masks, 10 Reasons Why Mask Use Should Be Limited. And so in reading that, it got me really focused on digging down deep with that. And I found something in The Lancet. It's a systematic review It's meta-analytical, and it's by Derek K. Chu and his team, and it was of available, what they said was all available data on COVID-19, and this was published on June 27th in 2020. But to summarize, they identified 172 observational studies across 16 countries with no randomized control trials and 44 relevant comparative studies in healthcare and non-healthcare settings. Their findings support, what their eventual findings was they supported physical distancing of 1 meter, which to us in the United States is about 3 feet or more. But they put in there optimum use of face masks, respirators, and eye protections in public and healthcare settings should be informed by these findings and contextual factors. They said that they recommend that robust randomized trials are much needed to better inform the evidence of these interventions, adding that this is their best interim guidance. So what do you believe is the optimal use of masks, and what are some of the contextual factors that they're referring to?
Well, one of the problems with those meta studies is the data you get out are as good as the data you put in. So if their study was published in 2000, so they're looking at everybody else's studies. They're not actually doing the work on the meta-analysis.
Hold on. I'm sorry. If I said 2000, I was wrong. It's in 2020. So that's June 27th.
2020. Yeah, June 2020, June 27, 2020.
Yeah.
So they publish a meta-analysis. So what they're doing is they're going back and looking at all the studies prior to the day they submitted this.
Right.
So there's very little data in any of those studies that have anything to do with masking or social distancing. Social distancing didn't exist in 2019. as a term or as a measurement in any way. So another study was just published similar in The Lancet, and it just came up. It was July 31st. And what they looked at was millions of healthcare workers in non-healthcare worker setting. And they also set a similar line. And what they see is COVID-19 in the healthcare workers, regardless of any other factors, was 10 to 100 times more than the general population. So why is that? And from the purpose of the masks, it's really important. Healthcare workers are it's nosocomial spread, meaning the virus is coming from the sickest and infecting either in a laboratory system in our vaccines, which carry these viruses. So remember, when we're vaccinating people, we're injecting them with coronaviruses. So that matters. We're injecting them with retroviruses. We're injecting them with influenza viruses. We're injecting them with simian virus 40. We're injecting them with live enteroviruses like polio. And so when we inject people with those things, MMR, mumps, measles, three or more RNA viruses, you carry those and can carry those in your body your whole life, and your immune system silence those. So every injection wakes them up. And wearing a mask and making yourself hypoxic, meaning just the compromise of this, the oxygen going in and the CO2 going out, which is the first chapter of our book. They said, we're not talking about hypercapnia. That's too much CO2 in the blood. And this is where your CDC says, oh, there's no evidence for that. No, this is not what we're talking about. Hypercapnia is what somebody with COPD, or in my case, pleurisy, has. I always have on the level of a little bit too much CO2 in my blood because I can't. I'm susceptible. I can't breathe well enough. My alveolar macrophages, my alveolar cells in my lungs don't work. They never have. So the susceptible people, the susceptible people are immediately activating the endogenous viruses, waking up the retroviruses, waking up and literally causing that flame. So the mask is throwing gasoline on a fire, and it's the immune response is COVID-19. It's not the pathogen. SARS-CoV-2 is not the causative agent of COVID-19. And so it's important to know that you can get the same flame from simply putting on a mask. I can express the same cytokine storm that is associated with that infection. And I've never been exposed to that infection. So you see people, lab workers, nurses, doctors, testing positive, and you're looking at the activation of the dormant. So it's not exogenous. It's infection from within. And that's why I say my mask makes me sick, your mask makes you sick, and no mask stops the transmission of SARS-CoV-2.
So one of the things that I got out of that, you're saying that because it's somewhere between 10 and 100 times greater as far as healthcare workers getting COVID-19, is that suggest, because we know that all of them are wearing masks. So are you saying that they're getting it because the mask is bringing their immune system down, or they're getting it because it's just not working, or what? And we've got just about a minute before we go to break.
Absolutely. It's because it's both. It's because it's bringing their immune system down. We never wore a mask in the laboratory because we didn't want to get infected. But then the flu shots increase the possibility that you'll get SARS-CoV-2 from the similar flame and from the infection. So it's doing both. So you absolutely can't give a flu vaccine to the lab workers without driving COVID-19. And wearing a mask keeps it within and makes you sicker.
Okay. So we're going to take a break right now. When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about this debate now to where are asymptomatic carriers able to give this to someone else? Are they contagious? Are they passing it on to someone else? This, I seem to be getting information. It's all over the map. So when we come back, that's what we're going to talk about. So everybody stay with us. You're listening to Answers for the Family.
what Japan has stumbled on and what Taiwan has stumbled on, an inhaled steroid. They're using a different one than I'm using. The one I'm using, I think, is better. Inhaled budesonide with a nebulizer treatment. I'm also giving an antibiotic that'll cover walking pneumonia and other pneumonias called clarithromycin. And I also give zinc because that interferes with virus multiplication. But the silver bullet is inhaled steroids. And the reason I use inhaled instead of IV is because if you give a steroid IV or as a shot in the muscle that goes total body through the bloodstream or as pills that goes total body, you're turning every time, you're turning down the immune system, the ability to fight infection. Every time you're dialing down the ability to heal.
All right. Well, that was a clip from Dr. Bartlett. I was going to bring that up a little later, but that's okay. We can go into it now. So in regards to that, so my question, as I can now get to that one, is, you know, there seems to be a battle that's raging between doctors speaking out about the effectiveness or ineffectiveness of natural therapies and prevention and treatment strategies. So first of all, why do you believe that the doctors are being censored? And in this particular clip, if the most common trigger for asthma is infection with rhinovirus, doesn't it seem logical that an asthma medication with 20 years of testing and use should be looked at seriously in this situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I completely agree with what Dr. Bartlett just said there. And in fact, it goes along with everything I just said, because, you know, this SARS-CoV-2 isn't doing the damage. And so when you deplete, my husband uses an inhaler for his COPD. And so it's acting the same way the asthma medication does. So with the kids, with everyone, you use the asthma medication, the zinc prevents the hold of those viruses we don't activate. So yes, everything that is telling us are theories that have been tested and proven over the last, you know, 100 years. We know this, decades for treating the most vulnerable in our population, actually prove that the treatments are wrong. So that's why we are being censored, because, and it's not just Dr. Bartlett's, but of course, we know the data with hydroxychloroquine and the countries that use preventative measures with hydroxychloroquine, zinc, and erythromycin for the same reason he was using clarithromycin and the various steroids in that risk population with asthma. You use a subtly different formulation in my husband with his COPD and his risk. And this is exactly why they're censoring it, because when you know the cause, when you treat it and people get better or never get disease, you know the cause and you know you're right. So if what Dr. Bartlett is saying is correct, and it's been demonstrated in thousands of people, as has hydroxychloroquine use over a very large study. I have a graph that I think I provided you last week, you know, and everybody's saying, well, Sweden didn't lock down and Sweden didn't put people in masks and let them all go. No, Sweden didn't use hydroxychloroquine preventatively, and neither did United States. This is why the mask issue gets to be a big problem, because the mask is driving the disease. And so, and you can see that. And when you use the prevention strategies, the mask won't drive the disease. And again, it's everything they're telling us to do is just without data, without supportive data. So they must censor those of us in the practice field, like Dr. Bartlett. I don't practice medicine. I'm a chemist. And even like the doctors that have been using hydroxychloroquine and have come out, they've either lost their jobs and or some have been jailed using chlorine dioxide. I think of Mark Grennan and his sons, and we pray that they'll be let out of jail soon. But you see, when you have a solution and it doesn't fit the narrative, they simply must drive COVID-19 into the ground to remove our religious freedoms. This has nothing to do with medicine. This has to do with removing our freedoms in the country. And if they can get us all to walk in step, then they can force those next vaccines. And really they will kill and continue to murder millions, as the policies with, let's just say, the respirator have already murdered thousands in our world.
Well, going back to that clip, Dr. Bartlett mentions Taiwan. And so I did a deep dive into Taiwan to figure out what is it that they were doing so that we can have an idea of what's working and what's not working. Now, Taiwan has a population of 23.78 million. Their density is 1,680 per square miles. That's huge. You know, I think for us, we're like, I don't know, 90 or something. I mean, it's a huge difference. Actually, I had it for us, and I don't know what I did with that one. But anyway, so it's certainly different than what it is here in the United States. They're much more densely populated. They've had 479 cases, and they've had 7 deaths. So in pulling as much information as possible, and one of the articles I was able to pull up was according to Joseph Hua, who's Taiwan's foreign affairs minister. He touched on a variety of different things. So the first one that was very interesting, it was very political, was he said, first and foremost, we don't trust China. So as soon as they said there's nothing to worry about, we went into action. And he said the rest of the world just kind of went, oh, well, I guess we should believe them. So he said that was the first thing. They immediately cut off all flights to China. But they said because of the fact that they focused on their elderly and on their sick, on the people that are unhealthy, the first thing that they did was care for them. And those were the only people that got quarantined. The rest of the country continued to function and continue to work. But they said that they did set up masks. What was the other things? Masks, sanitation places, gloves. But it was set up in, if you can't social distance, then, and they were using 5 feet as their break point. If you can't social distance, then they made a requirement that you still wear masks. So it seems like in different countries, there's different things. So I looked into Japan, I looked into Singapore, I looked into Sweden that you just mentioned, and some of the other countries near Sweden. In most cases, the concept of masks is something that they have had some aspect of it being used, and feeling that it is worked to their benefit. But some of those that have also done really well, have added in other things, like you said, and one of which, and I don't remember which one the one Taiwan did, but as Dr. Bartlett said, it's one that is, that is an inhalant that they're using, and apparently it's working very well.
Right. Well, and that's importantly why we wrote our book, The Case Against the Mask, and we say 10 reasons why mask use is limited. So when we think about places like Taiwan and China and New York City, you think about the high levels of pollution. You think about the key of sanitation and things like that. And so sanitation with respects to, literally feces in the street and things like that in some of the poor countries has always driven disease and contaminated water. Again, we say mask use should be limited, and we protect my husband every year with the COPD, and if he wears a mask for even 5 seconds, he's going to literally be spitting different kinds of bacteria and things like that, and compromising himself, and he will be one of the ones to die because, as I mentioned, he already has hairline triggers on his hypercapnia, on the CO2 in his blood that drives these cytokine storms. We also think about the smoke during the Thomas fires. So we absolutely wore a mask, my husband and I, during the fires in Ventura County in the winter of 2017. So stayed indoors more and kept him away because we knew the smoke couldn't get in his lungs and irritate him, because that drives this problem. And again, it'll drive a a pathogenic spread as well. So in China, in Taiwan, in places where there are many, many people and pollution and poor sanitation or sanitation issues with water and soil and food, you can see how different bacteria and viruses work together. So you limit the use to where it's needed so that you don't irritate and inflame your upper respiratory cavity. So you don't, you know, that's why mask use should be limited. We have to think about who's wearing it and why and for what purpose. And it's exactly how I've only been married to my husband 20 years this year, but he came into in his 30s. He was hospitalized for a week with a serious microbial. So many, many microbes cause pneumonia, as you just mentioned, and that problem with the lungs, and it will drive other infections. So hypercapnia, it's infectious. So my husband is more likely to spread infection everywhere. But if he wears a mask, it gets worse. So he would, during the winter time, we keep him away from, cold. And he certainly doesn't fly planes well because he can't put himself into oxidative stress. So he hasn't had a single shot of any kind because we don't drive inflammation in my husband. And he's doing well. And neither of us have worn a mask other than the Thomas fires was the last time we wore a mask. So I think of 9-1-1 in New York City in 2001, there was so much microparticulate through the air that there's a real issue there. Dust drives inflammatory cytokines. We drove through the military base Camp Pendleton yesterday in a huge dust storm. And that's when we would want our mask if we weren't in a car with a filtration, because the dust won't go through the mask. The virus will. And so this is why my husband would literally become a little virus factory if he put on a mask. And this is why we wrote why it should be limited and we should think about it.
Right. It sort of fits into what Taiwan has done, because what they said was the very first thing they did was they did quarantine the old and the unhealthy, but they said it was for everybody's good. So yeah. What I'm saying is that if we would have followed their system, your husband would have been quarantined, but it would be for his good as well as for other people's good, rather than putting a mask on everybody and letting everybody intermingle.
Correct, and making everybody sick and spread the disease more. Because people will get sore throats. It doesn't have to be from COVID-19, but people become sick and start spreading more of other things and develop fevers and things like that. But because we're not looking at, it's just like you have a fever, you have COVID-19, you have that, you have a cough. No, there are lots of causes of coughs, like inflammation of any kind, the headache, the microvascular issues. So exactly right. We quarantine my husband every year.
I want to make sure that we get to this area that is, I think, very important to a lot of people. So I watched a video of a representative of WHO, which for those out there is the World Health Organization, say that asymptomatic carriers of COVID are not contagious. They have, right. But I also went to their website, and on their website, it's posted that asymptomatic carriers are contagious. What is the truth about the asymptomatic carriers, and what does science tell us about it?
The truth is the science clearly shows, well, number one, an asymptomatic carrier is a healthy person. So mm-hmm. Let's go back and think about it. Are they coughing? Have you and I coughed at each other once as we sat here? And I have a lung disease, listen to my voice. So I can cough if I put on a mask, but I won't. At any rate, so we're not coughing. The way the virus spreads in droplets, we're not breathing it on people. And the data are clear from a number of studies where somebody actually got sick. I think of in Europe, a ski trip, 70 people on a ski trip, one young man, you're up above you're at altitude. So you're oxygen depleted anyway, which causes you to express more viruses, we just said. So, and that young man was in contact, got very sick, recovered. Nobody else, even though he was in close dorms on a ski trip with other young people, nobody else got sick. So the data support that there is, and the WHO actually said it, as you said, and within 2 days of making those comments, they quickly censored and removed from their website. And the New York Times has done the same thing as independent reporter Jeremy Hammond has shown in Three Things. It's propaganda masquerading as science, pun intended, because these news organizations and these organizations are saying, oops, somebody got out there and showed the truth. The truth really is asymptomatic carriers. These are healthy people. There's no such thing as an asymptomatic carrier of a coronavirus. They don't integrate into your cells and stay for the life of your cells. They're cleared. You develop T and B antibody and innate and adaptive immune responses, and you clear it. And the next time you see it, you're ready to go with a strong immune system. So when you will spread it is when you wear the mask and compromise yourself.
Now, that brings me to another point. I'm glad you brought that up. So one of the things that I read was that in Germany, that what they were doing is that they took anybody who had already had it and was now fine. They've run the cycle. They've taken their blood, and they said that from each person, they can make essentially three, I guess it would be a vaccine of sorts, but they can make three vaccines from that that can be given to three other people. And so what they're doing is that as they have one, that person now makes three other people in their mind unable to get it. And that, they say, is what has flattened their curve. Do you know about that one? And if so, sure, that makes sense.
Sure, it makes sense, because what they're doing is it's called convalescent plasma. So they do plasmapheresis. We've done it forever. We've tried to do it in AIDS and everything else. You purify the antibodies, and you can find neutralizing antibodies. That is where the antibody meets the virus and says, boom, you're neutralized. You're gone. You're out of the system. You can't infect somebody else. Now, not everybody who's convalescent will make neutralizing antibodies. But from those neutralizing antibodies, yeah, you can grow those up. And that's an immune therapy. So it's not really a vaccine. It's what we in this country call IVIG, intravenous immunoglobulin therapy. So where you can do it in that way. So you take 10 normal or healthy donors, you purify those antibodies, and you give it to the compromise. And yes, we've been doing it 40 years. And yes, that's how you do it. That's how in 2014, the spread of that highly pathogenic and deadly Ebola virus was stopped when the Dr. Kent Brantley actually recovered, and a young boy recovered, and those antibodies stopped the spread of the disease and from him. You can check my facts in a book called For Life. In the biblical sense of called for life, this was a Christian missionary, Dr. Kent Brantley, Kent and Amber Brantley. It's a short book, but you can see how this is exactly how you would have done it in this case as well. And the people who have recovered, remember, only 99.6% of the people who are exposed to SARS-CoV-2 never even get a symptom. So that's, again, why the asymptomatic carriers are not spreading disease, because they never get disease. COVID-19 is not equivalent to the infection. The infection is not the disease.
So I've tried to wrap my head around that as I've been gathering information. And it appears in those situations to where somebody is saying the opposite of this, it is a time in which somebody appears to have no symptoms, and then they take it. But apparently there's a small window of opportunity that they can be contagious, that's very short, right before they actually are now actually showing symptoms. Have you heard that argument, and what would you say about it?
Sure. That argument works for many, many infectious diseases, like even influenza or measles. But where there's an incubation period where, yes, you could potentially be spreading it, but I've got to spit on you. I've got to, you know, small children, this is why we had chicken's pox parties and measles parties. We're all over each other with our hands in our face, and they're drooling over mommy. Yes, in that case, they could potentially spread, but you must come in contact with the water droplets. The virus doesn't live in the air. So children literally hugging could be exposed to a particle or two, and they develop immunity. That's the whole idea.
You know, we've only got a couple of minutes, and I really wish that I had more time. I'm going to throw in a quick little story. I know that we have a lot of teachers that watch and that listen. Mm-hmm. I was a room dad for kindergartners, and the teachers told me, they said, now you realize that as a room parent for the first time with the kindergartners, that you're going to get sick. And I said, what? And they said, it happens to almost everybody. But they said, the beauty of it is that you'll do it the first year. And after that, your immune system will take care of you for the rest of the time. And so anyway, I just want to throw that out there for a lot of the teachers. That's
so important.
Yeah, they knew it. They just kind of said, prepare for it. It's, you know, it is what it is. So
yeah.
I want to ask a quick one. And again, before we run out of time.
Well, may I follow up just to say that's why it's so important. Everybody goes back to school. No distancing, no masks. Do your thing and we will build the herd immunity because those teachers are good, just as you said. And so that's where, again, protect the vulnerable. Let's get back to school.
Yeah. Now, the CDC recently stated that CO2 will slowly build up in the mask over time. However, the level of CO2 likely to build up in the mask is mostly tolerable to people exposed to it, and that it is unlikely that wearing a mask will cause what you just said earlier, hypocapnia.
Hypercapnia, and that's
hypercapnia. Okay.
Too much CO2 in the blood.
Okay.
And so that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about when you breathe in air that is less than, that is, every breath you take is 0.4% CO2. Mm-hmm. Every breath out is 4%. We're talking about you deplete. Every breath in of oxygen is 21.5%. Every breath out is 16.7%. When the intake of oxygen goes below 19.5%, you are already doing damage. You can pass out. You can do it. Doesn't have anything to do with hypercapnia. That is CO2 in the blood. This is what's going into your nose, into your nasal, into your mouth. And so when you breathe out, three breaths at 4% is above a toxic level to your nasopharyngeal cavity where it does some damage. So again, the CDC is twisting the terms in such a way that they say we're saying one thing. The mask does damage in only 20 seconds. And this was where you want to look at the Healthy American, Peggy Hall, thehealthyamerican.org. And she'll show you, there are films on that website to show you how long it takes before a truck driver will get below that level and can get dizzy and crash his car. Wearing a mask in a car is DUI in only 20 seconds.
Wow. Oh. So, well, Judy, thank you so much. I wish we had more time. We're running out of time. There were some questions that came in that I didn't get to that came in from listeners. So I'd like to ask you if it's okay if I can ask you those off the air and we can put the answers on our website. And if you would like, we can put them on your website as well. And in fact, for those that want to get in touch with you, share the website, please.
Our website is plaguethebook.com.
All right.
Plaguethebook.com. And yes, happy to answer those questions as we do through that website every day.
Perfect. So again, so that book is plaguethebook.com. The other book that is The Case Against Masks, 10 Reasons Why Mask Use Should Be Limited. Judy, thank you so much. I'll be in touch. And again, for everybody out there, just go to the website. I know that some of you have sent in questions. We appreciate it. We'll put them on there. You can go to the site and you will have your answers. Judy, thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Happy to do it anytime.
For everybody out there, the world is changing fast. So just imagine being able to anticipate the future and finding your best and most successful direction. So be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday as author Ann Jersch describes her book, Future Vision, which is packed with case studies, exercises, and techniques that will guide you through the 10 strategies that will help you get ahead in life. And please remember, you can visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or just subscribe to the show through iTunes, iHeart, Stitcher, YouTube, Spreaker, and SoundCloud. If you like what you hear, please leave a review, leave a comment, let us know what you think. It will help us reach more people, and I want you to know I greatly appreciate it. The next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page. Check out some of the latest posts. We have all kinds of things on there that we think is making a more positive place in the world. But if you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. Now, for everybody, be good human beings, be safe, be healthy, and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.